Services and Rural Health Policy will come to order, please. And if Bob Lawrence would sit down, we could get started. Okay, very good. Oh, Jay Netboy can stand if she wants. Okay, welcome on this beautiful... The sun is really shining out there, but we close the shades because it would be too bright for those of you sitting in back to have that sun shining in your eyes, so we want to protect you. Okay, we're going to have a couple of information hearings, which are very important because we're looking forward to the next legislative session when we have lots and lots of... No, we don't have lots of money, do we? No, okay. So we're looking forward to the next legislative session, and we want to make the very best use of the resources that we have. And particularly in the area of senior and people with disabilities, because the community resources are what make the difference. That's where the work is done, basically. And it's important that councils of governments, counties, cities organize and expand their volunteer base, perhaps, and get local resources, perhaps, to do some of the things that otherwise will end up costing us a huge amount of money. So we have to keep in mind the cost shift that will result in cuts of various services. We spend a lot of money increasing repayment rates for assisted living, residential care, to keep people out of the nursing home. We may not have that luxury in the future, the near future. So this is really, really important that we take a look at how we administer the services that we do have. Senator Edwards, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Appreciate you being
delighted
here.
To be here.
Okay, thank you. And Senator Telfer, as always.
Always good to be sitting next to you.
Yes, yes. Do you still have your snow tires on?
I do.
You
snowed
do?
Saturday night or Sunday night when I came over. It was snowing in the mountains.
And
Jeff studless, though.
Oh, okay. Studless. Okay. So you don't. You still travel in the grooves that are already in the road. So that keeps you from.
Fortunately, I didn't create those grooves, though.
Oh, okay. Okay. So we are going to have an update from Senior and People with Disabilities Division, SPD, Department of Human Services, current program status and outlook for 2011. Mary Gear, okay, would you come up, please? John Swanson, yeah. Okay, is this the good news part of the meeting?
Good cop.
Okay, we're prepared.
Chair Morsett and committee members, my name is John Swanson. I'm the budget director with the Department of Human Services, and I'm sitting in for James Taves as well as I can today.
Okay.
He asked me to present an abbreviated version of a presentation we've been taking around the state at our community forums for our 2011-13 budget preparation. You should have a PowerPoint in front of you, I hope. And I just kind of want to walk through that, and it will provide a little bit of information at the end of kind of what we're looking at in terms of challenges for the next biennium, 2011-13.
Just out of curiosity, how many of you have heard this presentation at the local level?
Perfect, then.
Have you?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, we're all in for the surprise today.
Well, I've been there, and I'm not overly...
Oh, you've seen it.
Okay, go ahead.
And again, this is an abbreviated version of in the interest of time.
Yeah.
If you'll flip to the second page there, at the top it'll say changes to DHS. One of the things we emphasized was one of the biggest changes is that the Department of Human Services, along with four other agencies around the state are going to be forming two agencies in this biennium, and then we'll be budgeting that way in 2011-13. The current Department of Human Services, which you can see on the top half of those boxes, which includes seniors and people with disabilities, along with children, adults, and families, public health, and the array of other medical-related programs, will join with the Public Employees Benefit Board, Oregon Educators Benefit Board, Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, high-risk insurance pool, in the Office of Private Health Partnerships to form two agencies, as you can see at the bottom, which will be what we guess we'll call the new Department of Human Services, which will consist of the Children, Adults, and Family programs that exist now and the Seniors and People with Disability programs. And then the Oregon Health Authority will be formed with the other agencies and divisions of the Department of Human Services now. As you can see there, we'll be including the Oregon Health Plan, the Division of Medical Assistance Programs, Health Policy and Research, Public Employees Benefit, Oregon Educators Benefit, Private Heart Health Partnerships, Medical Insurance, Oregon Prescription Drug Program, and Addictions Mental Health Programs, and Public Health. So all of the medical-related programs will then be formed in the Oregon Health Authority from those five agencies. What that looks like budgetarily is on the next page. What I did was I took this biennium's budget, 2009-11, and the total of all five of those entities' total fund budget is about $18.2 billion. $15.2 billion of it is the total fund budget for the current Department of Human Services, and you can see right in the middle there how that's distributed between the different program areas of the department. Seniors and people with disabilities comprise about 22% of our budget, 21.8, about $3.3 billion. Total funds, that includes the general fund portion, any other kinds of funds we get, and then the matching federal funds that we bring into these programs, which I'll talk about in a little bit here. The rest of the other four agencies that will come into the new world, if you will, total about $3 billion. And most of that is in the form of other fund sources, not general fund, which we'll look at in a minute. So that's today's budget world, if you will. The next page takes that same $18.2 billion and puts it into the two new agencies that we'll have for the next budget, 2011-13. So out of the 18.2, about $7.2 billion of it will be the new Department of Human Services. As you see, the two agencies we already mentioned earlier, the two divisions that will come together, with some administrative services. We're still well into the planning and work through how this is going to actually work in terms of shared services, so we put an estimated amount of administrative services in these displays. The Oregon Health Authority will total almost $11 billion, and again, all of the four new agencies coming into combining with the Department of Human Services will go into the Oregon Health Authority and form that budget. So all of that $3 million additional total fund budget will go into the Oregon Health Authority from those four agencies. Okay. The other thing we pointed out at these meetings, and I want to make the same point here, is that in both of these organizations, you can see the next page, it says funding sources. Both of them will be heavily federally fund leveraged, we call. And that, as you can see, about 72% of the new DHS will be funded through federal fund sources, based on today's budget or this biennium's budget, and about 45% of the Oregon Health Authority. The DHS federal funds includes food stamps, which is about $2 billion of that. So that's one reason it's a little bit higher than the OHA portion. And then most of the rest of it is Medicaid and temporary assistance for needy families on the children's and family side. The point I want to make here, though, is that we're heavily federally funded, but those funds come into these budgets with strings attached. We have to match those funds with state funds in order to bring the federal funds into those programs. So much of this money is brought in on match programs, where for every dollar that's spent, $2 plus is spent by the federal government in those programs. and or maintenance of efforts programs where a certain level of state spending must be maintained in order to receive a certain level of federal funding to continue to get that. So the upside of that, obviously, is it brings a lot more funding into these programs and helps us to provide the services we need to Oregonians. The downside of it is we have to reduce the state funds if they become unavailable, as we just learned recently. We lose those matching federal funds. So reductions in the state funding sources in both of these organizations will bring with it lost federal funds, which makes those reductions even much more difficult.
Now, at some point, I want you to talk about the maintenance of effort programs that we, because those are, we have to maintain.
Yes, let me just interject that now. A good example of that is the temporary assistance for needy families, okay. And that's in the Children, Adults, and Families division. That program is what's called a block grant, a federal block grant, which I believe it's about $332 million a biennium that we receive from the federal government for that program. But in order to continue to receive that, we need to spend in the form of state funds, general fund and other funds, about $130 million. If we're unable to do that, then the federal level of the block grant could be at jeopardy. And so it's not a matching program, but it's a required maintenance of effort that we have to keep spending at in order to continue to get that level of federal funding. So it's still a leveraged program where we bring those federal funds in by spending a certain amount in those programs from the state side. The other thing that heavily federal fund leverage does on a downside is that these federal funding programs are what we call siloed. They're intended for certain eligibility, people with certain eligibility criteria. They have specific constraints and obligations that we need to meet in order to continue to get them, which makes it more difficult for us to put together comprehensive services, which we'd like to do more of the wraparound type services. And it makes our budget more difficult and complex and difficult to manage. Again, when we lose the state funds, we lose the federal funds, and so we have to take that into account when we're looking at options to try to reduce our budget if we have to go through that.
Before we get off of that maintenance of effort, we're going to be talking about OPI, Oregon Project Independence, which is not a federally funded program. There are a couple of questions that could be raised. Should we try to make it a federally funded program so we can get a match? That would be one thing. We may not want to do that. Is that in any way count as a maintenance of effort for doing some activities? Maintenance of effort. Go ahead. Is there any relationship between the two?
Good afternoon, Chair Morissette and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mary Geer. I'm the Administrator for Licensing and Quality of Care in Seniors and People with Disabilities. Chair Morissette, I think you're going to hear some presentation on OPI and kind of its future before too long, and questions about what OPI might look like in the future and should it be matched and even can it be matched, is a question to look at. In terms of the maintenance of effort, in SPD programs, it's not as much of an issue on the maintenance of effort side as it is with our CAF partners. However, there's another or a different MOE that came with the stimulus funds that we've needed to pay attention to, and that's the maintenance of eligibility. And so the eligibility pieces are huge strings that are attached to the stimulus funds. And what that means is that in order to accept the federal funds through the stimulus package, we needed to not cut eligibility for our programs, or we would lose those stimulus dollars. And so one of the things that the feds are looking at is, are we maintaining our eligibility for our long-term care programs, and do we have are we serving the same number of people in our programs as we were in June, July of 08 when the stimulus money started flowing. So it looks a little bit different, or it's called something a little bit different, and it certainly impacts our ability to cut in the same way. But it's on the eligibility side of the block grant and the state needing to pay so much. So as John said, as we're looking at potential budget cuts, cutting the eligibility like we did in 2003 when we unfunded some of the service priority levels, that's simply not going to be an option, or we as a state lose all of our access to the stimulus money through ARRA.
And we can't put those three levels back in, right? We've talked about that a lot.
We have talked about that.
And John Mullen is going to be up here at some point and probably want to talk about that again. Oh, there he is. Yes, Senator Talbot.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mary, point of clarification. So the federal stimulus funds, are we still receiving them?
Chair Morissette and Senator Telfer, yes, we are. And there is as I understand it, there is a bill in Congress to extend those for another 6 months, which would take us through the end of this biennium in our cycle. But yes, we are. So what that means for SPD programs is that our federal match is a higher percentage than it has been in the past. So instead of 60-40, a 60-40 split, mm-hmm. it's more like 70-30.
No, I understand that. My concern was if, in fact, the legislature, for some reason, which I can't fathom, does cut it, did we have to return dollars we've already received? But if, in fact, we are continuing to receive federal funds, what's the if Congress does not extend that, what's the cutoff date? I mean, when does...
Chair Morissette and Senator Telfer, the cutoff date would be next January.
January, okay.
So there is a bill that in Congress that would extend it to the end of our biennium, but that's an uncertainty, right?
Exactly, yeah. Chair Morissette, exactly.
Okay, deja vu. It seems like last biennium we had to spend the first part of the session trying to figure out how to save money cut during that biennium. So if we have to do that in 11, mm-hmm. that will be a double whammy. Okay. John?
Okay. The next couple of slides are put in here to demonstrate where and how the funds are spent. You saw where they come from in terms of heavily federally funded and leveraged. The point we want to make here is that the expenditures of these dollars aren't in the human service building across the street. These are made to our clients or people in need around the state in terms of food stamp payments or TANF cash assistance. It's made through nursing homes, community-based care, nonprofit organizations, and communities around the state. So about 80% of what would be the new DHS budget would go directly to those types of services that are provided around the state. And about 16% of the new DHS, if you will, budget would fund our field services, which are, again, direct services provided by DHS staff around the state in 160-plus field branches where we do eligibility determination and placement in programs and maintenance of those individuals. And again, in communities around the state, and those individuals would be, at this point, doing eligibility for both DHS and the health plan, as it is now. Those would continue to do that. Likewise, on the Oregon Health Authority, it's the same message. Again, 93%, 94% of that budget would go out into communities around the state in the form of payments of insurance or to doctors, hospitals, managed care organizations. The thing that I will link that to, though, is when you're talking about reduction options, really get down to, boil it down to like four that you can use in varying ways. One is, obviously, we can look at the field services and see if there's any efficiencies and things we can do to reduce those costs. But as far as the programs go, you have a choice of either reducing the number of people that you serve, which with the eligibility requirements of the feds could be not the right way to go. Or you could provide fewer services, or you could pay less money for those services to providers. Those are really the four options that we typically have available to figure out how to use in least detrimental fashion in putting these options together of how we might deal with a shortfall. So basically that's why we're limited to those four. The last thing we point out is a picture there of the gorge and cliffs ahead. And if you look at the next page, I want to make sure these are really clearly noted, that these are preliminary estimates that we put together based on an estimate of what we think the cost of just continuing to do what we're doing today, just the same kinds of programs that we have now, in 11-13 biennium, looking at inflation and caseload growth that we measure all the time. So if you see that second line down there, it says maintain current services. We think it'd be about $8.3 billion total funds to continue to do what we're doing today in for the Department of Human Services, the two program areas I talked about, children, adults, and families, and seniors, would be about $8.3 billion.
Now, I understand that there was a revenue forecast this morning. Are these numbers?
These haven't been adjusted for that. This was done before.
Yeah, well, yes, obviously.
Yeah. I didn't know that one.
So, what you're telling us right now is...
worse.
Well, what you're telling us is based on the old number, on these numbers.
Okay. Correct.
And what you're not telling us is worse.
Probably.
Yeah. Okay, so we can keep that in mind.
Keep that in mind.
Senator Winters.
Just a quick question on your maintaining current service level, and we realize that it has to be adjusted based on the forecast today. But what percentage is roll-up cost?
Of what?
What percentage is roll-up cost on your in here?
Well, I don't know that I have it broken down. Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Morissette and Winters. I don't know that I have it broken down into that level. The majority of the increase in this projection is projected increase in caseload into the next biennium and inflation costs, which I guess you could consider some of that roll-up of who came on now. So that's the majority.
At some point, you'll have those figures.
I will have those figures. This, again, I would want to reemphasize, is preliminary estimates that we put together. So, again, the current service level at about $8.3 billion. Expected funding level, basically taking what we have today, and as mentioned earlier, our federal stimulus funds at this point in time are expected to not continue past December of this year. So there's about $240 million worth of stimulus money in the seniors programs alone that would not be there next biennium. So what I did was I extracted out, assuming that that would not continue, the stimulus funding. We projected some increase in state funding, which may or may not be there, but the assumption was that the economy would recover to some degree and we'd have some additional funding, and assume that a good portion of that, a similar portion of what we're getting today, would be matchable in federal funds. Total it all up, and I came out to about $7.6 billion of available funds. So if those are accurate, we'd be short by about $700 million of meeting our current service level in 2011-13 for the new Department of Human Services. And then I want to mention the last development cycle for this year's budget, this biennium's budget. We put together a budget, an agency request budget, that identified what we felt were needs around the state to meet human service needs, regardless of whether the funding was there or not. We did receive a portion of those. There was about 196 policy packages that we put together for the Department of Human Services, and they totaled over $4 billion. We got 17 of those and some money. And so what I did was I took the remainder that didn't get funded through the process and broke it into the two agencies, Department of Human Services and Oregon Health Authority, and it would add another $600 million to the current service level to get to that needs base. But the point I want to make here is we're short of just our current service level at this estimate here. And then the next page is the Oregon Health Authority, same layout there, and shows a $900 million deficit based on this preliminary estimate. And then I know you're interested in getting to the seniors program, so I did this same kind of philosophy and put it together here for the seniors programs, and I estimate we'd be about $450 million short of continuing our current service level. And again, that's a little more than half of the Department of Human Service shortfall, and that's because more than half of the stimulus money currently goes to seniors programs, which at this time is not continuing on.
Now, I want to go back to the maintenance of effort and maintenance of enrollment. Is that what it...
Senator Morissette, maintenance of eligibility.
Maintenance of eligibility... which means that we have to be careful where we make these cuts in terms of the eligibility, otherwise we could lose more money.
Absolutely. So, Senator Morissette, as we're looking at potential cuts, the four areas John mentioned, one of them is a cut to the number of people we serve, and that typically means an eligibility cut, and so we need to be very careful about that. A second area is to cut benefits. So instead of the wraparound services that we might have for someone who's living in their own home, we might cut some of those. For example, we might cut the home-delivered meals program or the medical transportation program or something of that sort. One of the things that we have been talking with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services about, CMS or the feds, is waiting lists. There are a number of states who have waiting lists for their waivered services. What that means is that people wait to get the services that they're asking for and that they need. And one of the drawbacks of that, of course, is people may become more ill, more frail, and enter our system through the acute care hospital side rather than getting services. Another area we look at is rates. Those are provider rates. And, you know, as you've heard before, SPD is very constrained in this area. Our home care workers and our adult foster home providers are represented by SEIU, and so those rates are collectively bargained. Our rates for nursing facilities are set in statute, and so it requires a statute change in order to influence those rates. And so that leaves our community-based care programs. Assisted living and residential care are the rates that we have some control over without those constraints, and those are the providers that we have the hardest time competing with in a private marketplace. And then, of course, the last area we look at is our own field structure, the direct services to clients. And one of the things that I wanted to point out on the last slide with seniors and people with disabilities, as you'll see in the light gray at the top, is the needs-based budget that John didn't talk about at all. And that's what we believe we would need as a program in order to be fully staffed for the workload that we have and to fully fund all of the programs that we have. So when John talks about the $3.95 billion that we need just to maintain current services, that's with the understaffing and some of the program cuts that we've already suffered. So just for example, based on the efficiency studies that the department's done, we know that our field structure is down about 500 positions, simply based on what workload looks like. And going forward into the new biennium, we know that with increasing caseloads, we're going to need close to 300 positions in our field.
Wow.
Wow.
Okay. John, are you...
Well, that was my abbreviated version.
Well, thank you. Comments?
No, just, and I'm sorry that I was late. We got out of subcommittee on e-board a little late, and so I was rushing to get a bite to eat. But I caught just the end of the discussion on the stimulus money, and it's tied to some eligibility requirements. Is there some way that you can share with this committee the CMS document that actually specifies what our constraints are?
Chair Morissette and Senator Winters, we'd be happy to. Honestly, in the discussions that we've had with CMS, we have been told several times that there's clarification coming in the form of a state Medicaid director's letter about really the areas that we can look at for potential cuts, because as you might imagine, we're not the only state dealing with these same kinds of questions. So it may be that when that clarification comes, that would be the clearest document about what the constraints are.
So can I assume that this conversation is in a state of kind of flux and that not only are we wrestling with it, but other states are wrestling with it, and the feds haven't really decided where they're going to land and what they're going to do to states yet?
Four or two.
Oh, yeah. I mean, either way.
Chair Morissette and Senator Winters, Perhaps they wouldn't phrase it quite that way, but perhaps we would. You know, the CMS is very interested in people not losing services and states continuing the services they provide, and yet want to acknowledge the budget difficulties that all the states have.
Then are we having a conversation with our congressional delegation on this particular issue and how they're weighing in to either extend the stimulus? I mean, what kind of conversation are we having, and not just Oregon, the other states, because we're not in this by ourselves.
Right. Chair Morris said, and Senator Winters, I know that my boss, James Taves, and Margaret Carter have a trip planned to D.C. to talk to our congressional delegation, and that James is very active in the national organizations that serve people, seniors and people with disabilities, the Agency on Aging and such, and are really advocating for what the state of the states looks like, also through the state Medicaid directors' organizations and such. So this is not just an Oregon message. It's clearly nationwide.
Well, I really appreciate Senator Winter's presence on the committee. She's been involved in these health care issues longer than I have, and has a really good understanding of what's going on. So thank you for being here.
You're quite welcome, and we're both becoming chronologically advantaged ourselves.
Yes. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator.
We're going to, Mary, maybe you need to stick around for a minute.
Okay.
And Barry and Scott, would you come up, please? Okay, we're going to have an update on Oregon Project Independence, and Barry Donfell and Scott Bond, Barry of Northwest Senior and Disabled Services, and Scott of the Cascade West Council of Governments. And Mary is waiting in the wings. Okay, so I guess this is an interesting situation, and I wanted to hear from both of you on your take on what's going on from your end and kind of the worst-case scenario, how we deal with the issue, and you've both been working on it for much, much time. So who wants to start?
Okay.
Barry?
Okay. I'll start. For the record, Senator Morris said, I'm Barry Donenfeld. I'm the director of Northwest Senior and Disability Services, which is the area agency on aging that serves Marion, Polk, Yamhill, Clatsop, and Tillamook counties. And I've been doing that for 20 years. Before I start with any testimony on behalf of O4AD, which is our state association, the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities, both I personally and O4AD would be remiss if we didn't put on the record a formal thank you to you, Senator Morissette, for your many, many years of being a champion for these issues, your passion and commitment, which I've seen in private meetings as well as public meetings, is something we all commend and applaud. And while I know you've still got 6-8 months to go on your term, this may be the last time I actually testify before your committee, so I wanted to make sure that I gave you those thanks from both myself and from the association.
Thank you.
Scott and I have divided up the testimony. Scott's going to speak a little bit more about the specifics of OPI, and I'm just sort of going to frame the climate that we're in from the more global level.
Okay.
Yes.
The budget notes. Okay, yes. Let me just kind of say where I think we would like to go with this at some point. Now, there was a document put out, in January of 2010. And this is the budget notes from DHS, Senior with People with Disabilities, and it deals with many facets of Project Independence. Now, what I am interested in is what we're doing at the local level, the single point of contact that we're working on, that I think we're achieving, what changes might be made both statutorily, and there is some opportunity perhaps to do some statutorial changes. So those are the things that we're working toward, and in September we will have another meeting, and if we need to do a committee bill dealing with OPI, that would be a good time to bring it forth. And in the meantime, between now and September, I would like to continue the discussion and have you come back in September and weigh in and see where we want to go. So,
okay, let me, Senator Morrison, let me try and respond on that level. We have, meaning the AAAs, have spent considerable time with SPD reviewing and inputting into the report you just referenced. Recently, we were informed by SPD that they were withholding the second 6 months of next fiscal year's allocation for OPI. So the allocations that we have for OPI carry us only through December 31st of this year, and after that, we are not allocated any funds to continue OPI. We were told that we would be able to spend those funds through the end of the biennium, which means that we can create a glide path to shrink the program first by attrition, because there is quite a bit of turnover in the program. People come and go, and it's easier to cut someone who's not receiving services than it is to eliminate a large number of people. There are about 3,000 people statewide that receive OPI. We've learned from the past that when we've closed intakes to the program, that the program shrinks pretty rapidly, and over 6-8 months it can reduce itself just through attrition by anywhere from a third to a half, depending on the part of the state.
There's in 05 we introduced a bill that would allow OPI to receive money from the senior tax deferral program, and unfortunately there was a misunderstanding with the then co-chairs that automatically excluded general fund money, which was not the intent, and there's nothing in statute that says that. That bill included service to the disabled community, and I understand that that is not necessarily being done. So my first question is, where are we on the senior tax deferral program?
We have been told that the senior property tax deferral fund is completely tapped out and has no funds available to move to the OPI trust fund, that the last $3 million of money in that fund that was available per the Department of Revenue was moved as part of this biennium's OPI allocation. And the rest was then, general fund was put back into the program for this biennium. So as of now, we have been told that for the foreseeable future, the property tax deferral fund will not be available for OPI in any way.
Now, as to the issue of dealing with the 19 and over disabled individuals under OPI, what's your...
As of now, none of the area agencies are offering OPI to that population that is under 60, because 60 is the eligibility age for OPI.
It was until we passed the bill in 05 and
true.
They lowered it to 19 for disabled people. So they're only paying attention to part of the statute.
And Senator Morris said we completely agree with you. However, the ability to add younger people with disabilities has never been given to us. There are no administrative rules that would guide that.
Oh, Mary, are you paying attention to that?
We think there was an agreement at the time that bill was passed that until OPI reached a level of funding comparable to what it had had at its height to serve seniors, that service to younger people with disabilities would not begin. But that's okay. Not a written agreement.
Well, this is, yeah, like the University of Oregon not having a contract and just doing things on the fly. This is the same kind of thing. Now, it kind of bothers me that these are backroom deals that say, well, we're just going to ignore the fact that we should create administrative rules just in case somebody wants to deal with the disabled 19 years and over. That has to be done. That absolutely has to be done. How you divide the money up, I don't know, but, you know, the statute, where's our statutory reference?
Here.
Yeah, 410... 435 expansion of Oregon Project Independence and so on. It, you know, statutorily it says this is what we're going to be doing. So I would recommend to the department that they come back in September with some rules, just in case we have lots and lots of money and we want to distribute it equitably among those in need. But well, and then the other thing is that some of these things, if they're not taken care of now, are just kind of forgotten over time and may never get around to doing it. And I know that when we passed that bill, there was a lot of pushback from some of the senior groups saying, why are you expanding the program when we can't deal with the seniors? But Project Independence means that people who need help in their homes should have it, and disabled people are eligible. So,
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Since you raised that, and is there any talk at all, and I'm on the federal issue right now, about a waiver or the ability to actually get matching monies for Oregon Project Independence and those issues? I you know, we've sat here in Oregon and developed a program that works. We've developed a system that is a continuous system. And simply because it's not within the federal guidelines, you know, we constantly have struggled. And I want to know if there's any conversation going on through our congressional delegation, through with CMS and others, to talk about, you know, continuing what we know works. I'm talking to the agency now.
Mary, would you please come? No, go ahead. There's a chair there somewhere. There you go.
Senator Morissette, with your permission, I'd like to defer to my colleague, Jeanette Burkett, who actually administers the OPI program and is much more knowledgeable than
sure,
I am.
Sure.
Good afternoon. I'm Jeanette Burkett, Administrator of Senior and Disability Services within the Department or the Division of Seniors and People with Disabilities. And Senator Morissette and Senator Winters, there is much ongoing talk, as Mary indicated earlier, in terms of approaching the federal government in the hope that something can be developed. And there is progress being made. James Taves also, as Mary said earlier on the other issues, is in conversation, and I do believe this is something that he and Margaret Carter will address on their visit to our delegation as well. There is lots of interest, for probably the first time in history, between CMS, Centers for Medicaid and Medicare, and the Administration on Aging actually talking together about combining programs and seeing the value of preventive programs such as OPI and making much better use of federal dollars to try to prevent people from coming on Medicaid. So, unfortunately, that's all there is so far, is a lot of talk in that direction. But we are hopeful that that things will move in that direction. I frankly, as you probably know, don't see the federal government ever taking action very quickly. So whether we could count on movement in that direction to sort of save us and save our OPI program this biennium or even next, I'm afraid, is a little bit doubtful.
Yeah.
But we are nevertheless optimistic. but we definitely believe that's the direction we would like to see things go.
I've aged quite a bit since we've been talking to them about this, so I know how fast they work.
Well, one of the interesting things is that OPI, we do serve people who have a higher income level than are normally served, but we do have, we charge them for
it. Cost avoidance.
Right? So, and that's the other question. Could that save the program? I mean, are there enough people who pay, who are willing to pay for the services they receive under OPI to continue at least that part of the program? No? Okay.
Senator Morissette, from our experience with the fees that we collect, based on the sliding fee scale that's in the administrative rules, if all other funding for OPI was removed and all that existed were the fees, the program would probably be able to serve a quarter of the people it serves now.
Okay.
Chair Morissette, if I might address your comments just a bit earlier about rule writing, administrative rule writing for serving younger people with disabilities. The division actually did embark on a rule writing group, and extensive work was done in 2006. So we do have administrative rules ready to file. The only reason that we did not do so was that we didn't have the funding that was adequate to make the expansion to younger people with disabilities.
Okay, so, but that's not a valid reason, because it seems to me that the people, that the intent of the bill was to make the disabled population from 19 on just as eligible as the seniors from 60, and so to say we're not going to change the rules until we have more funding for those people who are not worthy of belonging to our present program, that's not valid. I mean, if they're eligible to be served under the existing program, there should be rules to serve them. Now, whether or not they choose to do that at the local level, and it just seems to me like there could be some legal issues involved. If the disabled people feel shut out of the program, someone may say, hey, that's not fair, and I'm going to file a suit or something. But I just think that the rules need to be written to serve the people who are currently eligible. So could you please bring them next September?
Yes, sir. And I will say that we felt that way at some point, too. I think we've had this conversation.
Okay, well, I appreciate that. And
we did,
I'm not
make
saying
an attempt
that you,
to do
no,
that.
No, yeah, but I think it's important that we even the playing field. And if you're eligible, you're eligible under the existing statute, and there shouldn't be any question about it. Now,
we would very much like to do that, Chair Morissette.
Good.
Thank you.
So,
is one of the concerns is the potential of not being able to provide the service because you don't have the funding?
Chair Morissette, Senator Winters, the concern is not only that we would not be able to provide the service, but that we would have to withdraw the service or deny the service to seniors that are already on waiting lists. Or receiving services, unless there was additional funding.
Okay. I think that the disabled people should be on the waiting list. And at least they're on a waiting list, and at some point some of them will be served. I mean, at least there is some light at the end of the tunnel, rather than being excluded from the waiting list. The waiting list is never going to be eliminated in the foreseeable future, so you're saying that they will never be on a waiting list in the foreseeable future. So let's correct that. Put them on a waiting list. You'll bring that in September too, right?
Absolutely. You are preaching to the choir, sir.
Okay. Barry.
Yes.
Were you...
you said you had several questions on the report on OPI, and you only asked the first one, so I'm prepared to answer any others you may have.
The center the point of entry. Where are we on this senior disabled entry? Lane County has senior connections. It's a single point of entry. You can call any one of seven people in Lane County if you're a senior and have any problem at all, and they will help you solve it. That is a single point of entry. Do you guys have that?
Yes.
Good.
Senator Morissette, committee members, as Senator Winters indicated in her remarks, Oregon's system of long-term care, while heavily based in Medicaid, is still recognized as the best continuum in the country. And it does feature a larger single entry point than just about any other state has. All of the area agencies on aging, regardless of their size or whether they do the Medicaid program or not, all operate a service called Information and Assistance. That is a central focal point for people to at least get information and, depending on the assistance they require, some assistance. That exists in every community in the state.
Okay.
In the Valley, the four what are called transfer area agencies on aging, which are local government agencies that operate the Medicaid program in Multnomah County, Marion, Polk, Yamhill, Lynn, Benton, Lincoln, and Lane, are all participating now in grants with the state to further develop a concept that's called ADRC, Aging and Disability
ADRC.
Resource Centers,
right,
which is a national program that was started about 8 years ago that is intended to bring these single entry points everywhere in the country. My agency is partnering with Scott's agency on one of those grants. Multnomah and Washington are partnering on a different grant, and Lane is partnering on yet a third grant. And all of them feature different aspects of enhancing this single point of entry. For example, in Lane County, they're working heavily on the liaison between the long-term care program and the hospitals, and the discharge of people and what happens to them when they're discharged, and how we can work together to prevent readmissions and unnecessary placements into high-cost facilities with care coordination and other things. And you're probably familiar with that because it's in your district. The one that Scott and I are participating in is to further develop the concept of ADRC and to work on the information systems that would operate statewide, that would be the backbone of providing high-quality information through electronic databases and the ability to link people directly to resources who have the capacity to do that through computers. And then there would also be on-the-ground assistance for people who need that type of face-to-face assistance, because not everything can be done by computer or telephone. And I'm not as familiar with the grant that's going on with Multnomah and Washington counties, so I wouldn't want to describe it because I might do that erroneously. But there's a lot of work going on to expand the already existing single points of entry. Oregon is one of the only states in the country, if not the only state in the country, where you can go into an office that's connected to senior and disability services, have food stamp eligibility determined and issued, have Medicaid eligibility determined and issued, have case management assigned and a care plan written. And what we want to do over time is build on what we've achieved.
Now, this is the new front door?
It's very similar to the new front door. It's got a different name that we use as bureaucratic jargon because that's what the federal government calls it, and that's how they're funding it. But in many ways, it's exactly the new front door. It's a way for people to access the system and to expand what we do beyond the Medicaid-eligible population. Medicaid is a pretty expensive program that serves a relatively small number of people. The estimates are that in Oregon that If you take the actual number of seniors that we can count from census information, and you take the generally accepted figure that about 10% of the population has a significant disability of one kind or another, and you combine those two, there are about 1 million people in Oregon with who are either seniors or a person with a disability. And the Medicaid program, in terms of actual services, serves about 3% of those people. So there's an awful lot of people out there who might need very, very similar services but are not ever going to be able to get them through Medicaid.
Scott,
your turn.
Well, good afternoon. Chair Morissette, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Scott Bond. I'm the current chair of O4AD, and I'm also the director of Senior and Disability Services, which is a program of Cascades West Council of Governments, and we're serving Lynn, Benton, and Lincoln counties. You have a copy of what I prepared for the committee as my testimony. But the conversation has shifted a bit. So let me expand a little bit on what we're doing in terms of the Aging and Disability Resource Centers in our area. As Barry mentioned, we're partnering with each other and the state in this grant area. And the work that we are doing is at our local level creating a way for us to connect our region, having three separate counties and two main offices, one in Albany and one in Toledo. For us to be able to run an efficient operation and for us to be able to truly experiment through this grant to say that we have this telephone ability, email ability, and using all the technology available to us to have a single point of entry through this grant, we have been working to be able to create a connection so that no matter where somebody calls from, they will get one of our ADRC's team members. We've reorganized our staff into an ADRC team so that we now have six people a part of that team. And using the technology available to us, we have we're testing and we're still working out the bug, but we have the ability to say that we can collect calls from all across the country and answer questions and refer people to resources, whether they be within our region or to resources outside of our region. I think it's a very critical part of what we're trying to do in terms of these ADRC experiments, because these are just, frankly, pilots. These are dollars that we're using in Oregon to try to look and see what are the different ways that we might be able to implement an aging and disability resource center, and Portland being different than Eugene, being different than Salem, etc., gives us a chance to experiment with each of our organizations and each of the communities that we serve.
Now, Scott, did you say that this ADRC program is being used nationwide?
ADRCs, as Barry mentioned, it's a federal creation where they have, for the last 8 or 9 years, put federal grant money out there with states responding, where they have proposed to the federal government to create aging and disability resource centers all across the country. And so what we have is 8 years worth of pilot projects. Some states have been able to add additional funding and have been able to roll out certain aspects of an aging and disability resource center across the state. And other states, and I'll use the state of Washington as an example, received a grant which was to begin an aging and disability resource center in the Pierce County area, which is Tacoma, just south of Seattle. And as far as I know, there hasn't really been any development outside of that county since the time they've gotten the grant. So you can see that there's a very wide...
Do you know anything about the state of California?
State of California. Do you know anything about California?
Yes. California was the recipient of several ADRC grants. They started specific grant-funded ADRCs in a couple of different parts of the state. And
San Mateo County?
Yes.
You're kidding. No. okay, I just have to take a minute. My sister, who is an elderly lady, 10 years older than I am, and a veteran, needs assistance. I've been calling Medi-Cal. I talked to San Mateo County. I'm looking for a single point of entry, someone who can advise her about the resources that she has and where she can go, and I have had no luck at all.
I can help you with that. I happen to know the Area Agency on Aging director.
Well, it's interesting because I've called the county and I've been you're referred to all of these different places, and it's ridiculous. I think it would be nice if there was this nationwide hookup, because you said that you actually communicate with people outside of your area.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
Senator Morrison, one of the things that Oregon did that virtually no other state has done is that when you get past this single point of entry, our system is not fragmented the way it is in California. Someone in California who needed the same services that they would go to just one of our offices to get, if they lived in San Mateo, would probably have to go to four different offices to get all that package of services, because each one does a different part of it.
Yeah.
And that's where we have made a lot of progress that we can build on, but we have to do the building.
Okay. I'm really, 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 really pleased and proud of what we're doing in Oregon. And I know, you know, I've worked with Scott and you and Katie Metzger and others on this, and it's really important for seniors. People of any income, if they're a senior, can have some help in finding what they need. Okay. I interrupted your...
That's all I have on the ADRC.
Barry, did you have any other...
Nope.
Mr. Chair, just for the record, because I asked the question of the agency about conversation with the feds, and our good staff person noted that in the Oregon Project Independent Budget Note package that was put together by DHS, Seniors and People with Disability, there is a notation here that the ADRC as a single entry point for services. They reference Congress Project 2020, which I'm assuming that to be implemented by 2020, that inside of that is some talk about OPI and how it fits. But, you know, by 2020, I won't be here.
OPI, we're
going to... Where are you going?
Yeah, where are you going?
Where are you going?
It's 10 years from now.
Well, where are you going?
Yeah.
I might be in the Caribbean.
Okay. Take me with you.
Okay.
I'm saying that to say that we still have to get from 2010 now, 2011 and 13, and we still have an infrastructure that we all care something about and a system that we care about. So 2020, and I'm glad that they're having that discussion nationally. I just wish there's some way that we can push CMS to actually be a little more proactive than 2020.
Okay. During the interim in 2009, the first February session that we had, we had a $10 million appropriation that went to increase the reimbursement rate for assisted living and residential care. And that was a critical move that we made, because the alternative, and I don't have that piece of paper with me, but how much it would cost to go to a nursing home and how quickly we would spend $10 million on nursing home care. in the state of Oregon. If the assisted living residential care facilities said, no, we're not going to take any more Medicaid, we're not going to take them, period. In fact, there was one facility in Newport, or maybe it was in, ejected someone on Medicaid from their facility, and that was a one-time-only thing, but then the daughter of the lady came to our hearing one time and said, we can't find a place for my mother, and I don't want to have to drive all the way to Bend. So I guess what I'm getting at is we have to understand the worst-case scenario, the repercussions, and what we may have to pay if we don't do some of this stuff up front. And so what I think we need to focus on are the cost shifts. There's a different... Barry, what's the terminology you came up with instead of cost
that
shift?
That you liked so much, Senator Morrison?
Yeah, that I like.
Cost avoidance.
Cost avoidance. Because a cost shift implies that there's something you're going to... Well, what does a cost shift imply?
That you just move money from spending it here to spending it there.
Yeah, okay. So cost avoidance, then, is you save money. You can avoid costs. Well, it's like, you know, either pay me now or pay me later. You know, I'll change your oil for you in your car, but if you don't want to do that, then you're going to have to put in a new transmission. And I think we have to focus on that during this difficult time when people are making decisions what to cut, because some cuts are going to cost more in the long run. Now, you can make that argument for drug, alcohol treatment. You can make it for all kinds of things, but when you're dealing with seniors who are going to go to a nursing home if they have no place else to go, and it's going to cost how much a month in a nursing home, $6,000 or more, up to $12,000 depending on 24/7?
It depends on whether they enter as private pay.
Right.
Yeah.
And spend down, or whether they enter as Medicaid. The Medicaid rate is set, and it is higher than all of the other rates, but it's considerably lower than the private pay rates.
Well, yeah, but I mean the state's share of Anyway, I think we have to spend some time on that, and I ask you, those of you, you know, in the Council of Governments around the state, to come up with some information that you can bring back in September, and we can have this discussion. And when the Ways and Means Committee is, you know, thinking about where the cuts are going to be made, this is going to be very important information to have. So, any other questions, comments? Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Yes, you want mine? I'll find you some.
Okay, we're going to have Tom Burns. Tom, are you here? Yes, you are. Okay, we're going to have an updated discussion. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you, Senator.
The Oregon Prescription Drug Program, OPDP, Tom Burns, Director of the Pharmaceutical Purchasing Oregon Health Authority, OHA.
If it doesn't come up, they have a slide.
Oh, we're going to have.
Well, you also have a handout, is the same thing. So if this doesn't come up quickly, we can save some time and look at the handout.
Okay.
You don't have it yet.
You don't have it yet.
Nope.
Don't worry about it. Mr. Chair, members, I'm Tom Burns, Director of Pharmacy Program for the Oregon Health Authority. I thought, while Sandy's handing this out, I'd take a personal note, if I might. I was reviewing this program, and I went back to its beginning, and we'll talk about it in a little history, but I thought it would be appropriate to say to you, Senator, that this program would not exist without you. You started this program with your first bill back in 2003, and you have shepherded this program today. And you'll see some of the wonderful things that has been done. But I think on behalf of every Oregonian who has access to this program and who has saved over the last 5 years $26 million, that you deserve an outstanding hand of thanks. And so I just thought I'd say that personally before we get started.
Thank you. Thank you.
So you have the handout in front of you, Mr. Chair, and in the first slide I'm going to talk about the milestones that brought this program to where it is. In 2003, Senate Bill 875 is passed that created the program.
Let me stop right there.
Uh-oh. Am I wrong?
No, you're absolutely right. But Mitch Greenlick is the one who brought this whole concept together, and Mitch couldn't get it going in the House side, so I started in the Senate side, and so Mitch has been part of this ever since. And so
tomorrow I'm going to say the same thing to him. But
I just want that for the record, because he has been involved in this all along.
Yes. But anyway, Senate Bill 875 was passed to create the program, and it was created for those people who were over 55 and who had incomes of less than 185% of the federal poverty level. It took about 18 months for the program to become up and operating, and on March 1st of 2005, we went live. And in May of that year, we enrolled our first group, which is still with us, the Southern Oregon Head Start Program, was the first group to join this program. In 2006, the governors of the two states were facing the same problems that many of us were facing, and that is the need to find ways to encourage people to take advantage of the discount programs that were in place. So the two governors of Oregon and Washington got together, and we created the Northwest Prescription Drug Consortium, which merged the discount programs of Oregon and Washington, and the concept of providing ways of granting discounts to consumers when they purchase their drugs. In 2006, AARP put a ballot initiative together, Measure 44, which removed...
Now, wait.
He's in the room. Don't I get
to give him credit for it? Wait. There was a ballot measure... number 22 that I introduced before we dragged the AARP kicking and screaming into this program, and it was literally kicking and screaming, and they were the 800-pound gorillas in the room that if they came onto it, it would succeed, and if they didn't come onto it, it wouldn't. Well, they did come onto it, and so it was a successful initiative. Without their participation, it would not have happened. But number 44 was the second one. Number 122 was the first one. And I shamed them into joining.
Well, the shame worked, because the voters approved that. And in doing so, they removed the age limits and the income limits. And then in 2007, we had Senate Bill 362, which went even further, which said not only... are there no age limits, but it said if you are underinsured for prescription drugs. And that's an important distinction, because many of us have insurance that pays for our prescription drugs, but they may not pay for the drugs we need. And the OPDP program and the provisions of Senate Bill 362 allows those of us who are underinsured because our drug is not covered to get access to the program. And it also said we encourage private entities and labor unions to join the program. And so the program is now in place to where virtually every citizen of the state of Oregon can join the program. In 2009, again, Senator, you brought forward Senate Bill 335, which did a number of things. One is it increased our ability to contract with rural pharmacies, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. But it also gave the program the authority to create a new program called a group purchasing organization, which allows us as a group to go out and contract directly with manufacturers for discounts, because up until now, manufacturers have been reluctant to grant discounts to this program. The discounts that are available have come mainly from the backs of the pharmacists, and that's something that is not sustainable, and we know that.
Now, I won't be here in 2011, but I hope that there is a bill that would carry it one step further, which 735 had to drop from our bill, and that is... to include Medicaid.
Well, Senator, I think you're absolutely right, and it's something that we should examine and talk
about. Are there any pharma people in here that are jumping up and down?
I saw one sitting in the corner. Actually, there's two in the room that I recognize from my old days.
Okay. Richard is back there shaking his head.
On the next page, Senator, you will see the growth of the program from December of 2005, where we had 4,700 people, to today, where we have over 314,000 people in the program. All of them, some of them are in the discount program. That's about 173,000 of them are in the discount program, and the rest of them are groups that have joined. The biggest group is the Oregon Education Benefit Board, which joined us in 2008, and we've recently added OHSU as our last large group to join the program. And the next slide shows the just a graph of the same thing. You can see how the program has grown and expanded over years, and you can see the comparison between the discount groups, the people who are have no coverage, and the groups that have joined the program. The next page shows the advantage.
I'm sorry, Tom. One of the things that's hard to get out to people is that CMS allows seniors who are in the donut hole to save their receipts and get credit for out-of-pocket expenses during that infamous donut hole. And it's hard to get that out. And there's a lot of things that are hard to get out on this, but that's a very important feature.
You're absolutely right. Yeah. Any expenditures that are made in this program qualify for TROOP. True out-of-pocket expenses. I think I have the right word for that. TROOP is a shorthand for D thing. That's the expenses you have in the middle of the donut hole.
Yeah.
And so to the extent that you are taking advantage of this program, not only do you get your drugs at a cheaper price, but everything you spend for does qualify for when you come out of the donut hole, having exceeded, I think it's $5,000 in expenses for the program. Yeah. So the next slide shows the advantage of merging Oregon and Washington together, because while Oregon has about 300,000 lives in it, Washington has added 300,000 more lives to the program. And again, it is the same discount program, and their state employees are part of the program. And so we are now, through the Northwest Drug Consortium, representing close to 660,000 lives, growing at a rate of about 6,000 to 7,000 lives each month.
Now, PEB is not yet on board.
Correct.
Right? But there are discussions. They have had discussions.
We've had discussions with them, and we are in a timing issue here.
Yeah.
And here's what our problem is. Right now, OPDP, the Northwest Drug Consortium, contract with our pharmacy payment system in the form of ODS, is set to expire in January of 2012, at the end of 2011. We just this last week released an RFP to come up with a new payment program and a new system for people to manage how we pay our pharmacists, how we manage our beneficiaries, how we negotiate with the plans. That program will be in place in October of this year. PEB's program for the state employees also expires in January of 12, and so they, at the same time as we are going out for an RFP. They will take our RFP that will be done in our contract that will be done in 2010 and say to their bidders, we wish you would use OPDP. They haven't gone so far as to say you shall, although with a new healthcare authority, that is still an open issue. But our timing is to have in place our new pharmacy benefit program so that that program can be tied into the new PEB one. And hopefully by January of 2012, PEB will be part of this as well. But we have to be able to prove we're cheaper. We think we are. We certainly were with OEB. And we think that some of the programs we put in place will prove that. So the next slide talks a little bit about the program utilization. And it's kind of interesting. If you look at the groups, that's the OEB, the OHSUs, the SAFE, they do about typically 6 to 18 claims per year for their members, while the discount program is doing 4 claims a year. Now, remember, the discount program are people paying for it out of their own pocket, which means that these 4 claims are costing the beneficiary the money. Yet, despite that, we do 50,000 claims a month for the discount program. That's 50,000 Oregonians are getting drugs at a discounted price through this program that they're paying for themselves. We do 1.2 million prescriptions a year and sell $334 million worth of drugs through the OPDP program. This is just the OPDP program, not the Northwest Drug Consortium, the Washington. This is just in Oregon. And the members are receiving an average price discount of about 40%. And as I said, it's saving $26 million over the last 5 years for taxpayers in the state and has cost the taxpayers nothing because the program is 100% self-sustaining from a small transaction fee we put in every script we get. We've also addressed the issue of how to do outreach, and this is really the problem. How do we get people other than groups to join the program? So we've mailed 55,000 flyers to the Health Resources Commission to people who are on the wait list for OHP. We send easels with information about the program. This is a small version of it that are in every employment office in the state. And these are there with an application that they can pull off as they go in to collect their unemployment benefits. There's information there. We work through CAF and send mailings out to their beneficiaries and their population. We send it home through the schools. We encourage the schools to hand it out to the students, and the students take it home to their parents. And one of the advantages of creating the Oregon Health Authority is that when we brought the groups together, it allowed us to look across various silos, and we went and looked at the Healthy Kids program. Every kid who's getting signed up for Healthy Kids, their parents are not necessarily getting health care, but they're getting an application to OPDP in order to help reduce the parents' cost of the drugs, because the kids will get it through OHP, but through Healthy Kids, but the parents won't. And then foster kids who are exiting the foster care program get enrolled in the OPDP program. One of the
AARP has been very cooperative, and they give a grant to Senior Connections in Lane County to distribute information on this program. So AARP has a continuing support role to play.
Absolutely. They are a partner of ours in helping get this information out. There's no question about that. One of the problems we are facing and is still not 100% resolved is
excuse me, Mr. Chair, can I ask a question?
Sure.
Since you mentioned AARP and there's a lot of members in Oregon, do they put a in their mail out to members in Oregon as one way of advertising?
They have in the past. Are you currently doing it? I know they have. I know they did in 2007 and 2008 when we were first expanding the program.
Well, you know, the Chronological Advantage Group, every year you add more to that membership.
Do you really? I refuse to admit it.
AARP, when they came onto the co-sponsorship of the initiative petition, sent out petition forms to all of the members in the state. So they have definitely been part of, you know, getting the information out.
Yes. So we do face this problem of maintaining a pharmacy network, because right now, if you're in the urban area, pharmacists are willing to sign up for the program, but we do have a problem in our rural areas. Okay. And so Senate Bill 725 passed last year, created the critical access pharmacies. Using the Office of Rural Health, we identified 20 pharmacies around the state who were so critical to the community in which they live, that they function, that we needed to give them a better program, a better reimbursement rate for the cost of the drugs. We sent out letters to the pharmacies offering them a 10% increase in reimbursement rate. Now remember, this does two things. Not only does it mean that if you are in the discount program, your cost will go up, but for the OEB population, the SAFE population, their costs go up as well. And so any increase in what we pay to pharmacies just adds to the overall cost of drugs in this state. 17 pharmacies have joined the program. 17 of the 20 have joined the program. One declined and withdrew as of March of this year, and we put a process in place to make sure that every client that was served by OPDP knew where the next nearest pharmacy was. And two pharmacies have not joined OPDP, have never joined OPDP, and continue to ride outside the program. Other than that, of the 700 pharmacies in the state, we have every one of them, except these two. So where do we go from here? And we have a great foundation put together, but we're looking forward. I mentioned group purchasing organizations. This is a way that we can come together as a group and go directly to the manufacturers and get discounts.
Now, I know where we can go to the manufacturers and get discounts and where we can store the drugs that we purchase. We use the state prison as a storage place, and then we could distribute it from there. Now, I see the pharmacy rep that is reacting to my comment, because I threw that out in 03 and he went berserk that, what do you mean you're going to bypass the distribution system and create your own? Aside from that facetious remark, this was meant to be a bulk purchasing program. It's not a bulk purchasing program. And that's something that's always bothered me, because we went into this with the idea that we would be a bulk purchasing, and it turned out to be basically a discount program. Well, that's why we're working on this. Right. This is a work in progress, and Absolutely. We're halfway there. But when we get a bulk purchasing, when we get rebates, when we get all of those things, then we will have achieved what I hope.
Right. Well, Senator, the GPO program is exactly a bulk purchasing program.
Yeah.
It allows us to go directly to the manufacturers and buy the drugs from the manufacturers and distribute it. We are using that in a pilot project that went live on January 1st for the OEB population. And we are using our mail partner in this program, and they have entered into contract with manufacturers. They are getting discounts from manufacturers, and while it's only the mail portion, we are saving $7,000 a month off of what it would be if we had not entered into the group purchasing organization. We believe this is a model that can be expanded to the retail pharmacies, and we intend to roll this out in the near future to the retail pharmacies once we have proof of concept that it really does work inside a single mail distribution program.
And that can be done without statutory...
You gave a statutory authority in 735.
Oh.
That was one of the other provisions of
735. 735 did include bulk purchasing among nonprofits?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Exactly.
Okay.
And OEB qualifies as a government entity, therefore, by definition, a nonprofit.
Okay.
And that's how we're using
that.
That's right. We're also looking at the possibility of using 340B pricing. Again, the same type of mechanism of finding a way to distribute the drug is what is the hang-up with. I mentioned the PEB contract. We anticipate being able to bid for the PEB contract, which will go out in the fall of this year. We're looking at the question of, because of some federal law changes, why are the managed care organizations continuing to sit behind the PBM, 15 different PBMs in the state, as opposed to joining the OPDP program with one single purchasing site, and again, expanding our population so we have more people in it. We're looking at a statewide drug formulary. House Bill 2009 gave specific direction to create a statewide drug program. That formulary is being put together right now. We anticipate it going live for the Medicaid fee-for-service program in January of this year.
Wow.
It will be used to measure how the managed care plans are doing with their prescription drug benefit. And if it turns out that we are getting a much better deal than the plans are, then we'll look down the road to potentially moving the plans into a statewide formulary.
Are you becoming a drug czar?
Senator, when I took this job, I was asked if I was going to be a drug czar, and I certainly hope not. That was not why I took this job.
What about the consortium that Oregon is involved in with, I think, the state of Michigan? What about the prison population? Corrections. Who deals with the prescription drugs and the corrections?
We are looking at the corrections as a possible partner with us. House Bill 2009 did not move the corrections health care into the authority, so we have to sort of go and negotiate with them. We are, however, looking at local county prisons. I'm sorry, jails. Counties run jails. State runs prison. Local county jails, and are in discussion with Clackamas County to become their provider of drugs for their jails. And we believe that we can do it cheaper than they currently have, and that's an ongoing discussion. And hopefully by September we may have an answer to that. And then the other program that we're looking at is through our GPO model is, can we provide some portions of durable medical equipment, for example. the devices that are needed to measure your blood glucose if you're diabetic, syringes. Right now we are paying full retail for that through the pharmacies. Could we get them cheaper through the GPO by negotiating directly? So I'm excited, Senator. I think the program that you created is a program that we will see in the next 3 or 4 years really blossom into a fabulous program that will allow us to really reduce the cost of drugs in the state.
Okay. What is the purpose of the PBM of San Diego? Do we still contract with?
We don't have, no. We use ODS right now. As
ODS is the administrator.
Yes.
There
was a PBM. There was Walgreens, I believe.
Walgreens came on early on, and then there was one in San Diego.
Oh, MedImpact sits behind ODS. We contract with ODS.
What do they do? What is that PBM?
Well, for those people in the groups, they actually are right now going out and negotiating prices on our behalf.
You mean not ODS, but
MedImpact.
MedImpact.
Right.
Okay, so that's what a PBM is supposed to do, right?
Yes. They are doing exactly what they're supposed to. We anticipate with the new RFP that we can bring that in-house and do it ourselves.
Okay.
And that's one of the things that's in the RFP to see whether that's possible to be done.
What can we do with the Medicaid?
Medicaid, we can create a statewide drug formulary or a preferred drug list and leverage potentially across Medicaid for placement on the preferred drug list. Washington does this. Washington has taken their Medicaid program and their state employees program and through an algorithm looks at the price they get for the Medicaid and the price they get through their PBM for the state employees and creates a single formulary. We can do exactly the same thing in this state, and looking down the road, I anticipate doing that as well. But that's a 2 or 3 years down the road project. At this point, we do not, by federal law, have the ability to leverage formulary placement with Medicaid
right.
pricing. Okay. And there's a wall between the two that we just can't cross. We can do what Washington does by bringing it up and adding this plus this.
Yeah.
But we can't just look at the Medicaid pricing, whereas you know we get much better prices.
I think that we tried to do that in the last bill. That
right.
would be what Washington
right.
did.
Yeah.
Okay. And there was pushback, and we didn't want to jeopardize the bill, so we took that out.
Right.
Okay. Just a little more substance on your statewide formulary.
Certainly. First of all, Senate Bill, or House Bill 2009 specifically directs the authority to create a statewide drug formulary, or as I've been told by my lawyers, I have to refer to it as a preferred drug list because formulary is not something that we can use, although it's easier. We started with the Medicaid preferred drug list. The Medicaid preferred drug list has 30 classes of drugs that has been in place for a number of years and has been an ongoing way of controlling drug costs in the Medicaid program. There, however, are another 70-some-odd classes of drugs that are recognized through the Medicare Part D program. We are right now looking at the next 40 classes of drugs. We are going through a process. We've created a subcommittee of the Health Resources Committee to act as a PBM. We have brought in the evidence that has been created from the public domain, and that is being put together and consolidated for us by First Health. They are acting as a consultant on this, and we will have by January 80 classes of drugs covered, and that will be an enforceable PDL. It will be enforceable for the fee-for-service population. And as I said, we will then have a basis on which to look at costs and compare those costs to what the plans are spending. And if we can do it cheaper, we will be looking at whether there are ways to encourage the plans to come in and join it.
Just so I put it on the record, as everybody knows, one of my concerns is always mental health.
Absolutely,
Senator. And that we don't do harm as we look at, quote, cost. That sometimes lower cost doesn't mean that it is actually the best way to deal with the needs of the patient. So I will be watching closely as usual. I carved those out before. There's certain other classes of drugs, as you know. Cancer, I don't have to give you the list, because I think everybody knows the senator's concern as we deal with the, and so does the doc, the human being. So just keep that in mind as you're doing your studies.
Chair Morissette, Senator Winters, let me just give you an interesting statistic that we just discovered. We have a preferred drug list for the mental health drugs. We cannot enforce that preferred drug list, as you know, which means that doctors can prescribe anything they want. However, interesting, 90% of the prescriptions in the Medicaid program are, in fact, coming off the preferred drug list, even though we are not enforcing it, which tells me that the doctors are understanding that there is a need to look at a preferred drug list and a way to use it. But we do not enforce it, and there is nothing in our current plans to enforce that.
Because, yeah, as you know, I have the other problem since we're talking about that, and that is that not everybody metabolizes things the same way. We also have the issue of the ethnic minority group that often can't take, you know, what the Caucasian. So, I really subscribe to my physician and your physician and Senator Morissette's physician to know what my body can and cannot metabolize.
And Chair Morissette, Senator Winters, that's why the provision when 2126 was put in that says the doctor wins. Regardless of what our preferred drug list looked like, 2126 says the doctor wins the debate.
Where does evidence-based come in?
Evidence-based comes in through the process that we're using, of partly through the OHSU DERP process, as well as through the First Health, which is helping us look at the next 40 classes of drugs. The DERP process did the first 30. The First Health is doing the next 40, and it's all evidence-based. Yeah. It is not done by price. The P&T process has no price information.
So the preferred drug list is evidence-based?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So is that better than having the doctor just throw out a drug?
As Senator, the answer to that is, as Senator Winters points out, while 90% of the population may be able to work here, there are certain populations that can't work, and we have to have a safety valve for those populations.
But we do use evidence-based.
Absolutely.
Oregon is famous for evidence-based.
Absolutely. We started it. It's been around for 10 years and has gone to many other states.
But, Mr. Chair, just to put a little caveat in there, not all the groups are willing to do the clinical trials that you need in order to get the evidence base. I just have to put that on the record so that those who are hearing us don't think that everything that comes out through evidence base is in fact evidence based, because we do have problems with the clinical trials.
Point very well taken.
Dr. Bates, did you have anything to add to this?
I'm just here as an innocent bystander.
Well, again, Senator, I want to thank you for the work you've done in helping create this program, and I look forward to managing it on your behalf over the next couple of years.
There are a couple steps left to go, and until we have a true bulk purchasing discount program. And thank you very much for what you're doing.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator.
Okay, next session, progress report on this is a very important bill. Right, Dr. Bates?
Yes, I understand they're working on the RFP. I want to hear what the problem is.
Okay, Oregon Prescription Drug Program. Report on the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program. Yes, Lisa Miller. Hi, Lisa. Much blood, sweat, and tears.
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Lisa Miette, and I work for the Public Health Division and Department of Human Services. I'm the manager that's been tasked with being the project sponsor for the IT project that's known as the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program. I just prepared a few brief notes about progress to date, and then entertain questions. As Senator Bates alluded to, our RFP's almost ready to be posted. We think it'll be June 4th. Right now, it's in the hands of Department of Justice. Jack McDonald there is reviewing it for sufficiency. Our procurement team has worked pretty much day in and day out for about a month on the final process of putting the documents together. So I have to, for the record, state that the State Procurement Office has done a fantastic job working with us, as has Department of Justice. Our schedule for the remainder of the year, we look forward to a possibility of a notice of award to a vendor in August, and that would put us in contract negotiation with a vendor in September. We'd have a test implementation in November where we'd look at all the basic requirements that came with a basic system and then look what needs to be customized, have a security analysis, an analysis from the business perspective, and then we'd work with the vendor on any customization and then further roll that out and test it and then have go live in late December, January. Next, there are risks to the schedule. There will be a possibility of protests both at the time the RFP is posted and about the time the award is, the notice of award goes out. We've discussed this. I mean, we think it'll be a high probability but a low risk of really bringing the project to a halt. We think the partners at the State Procurement Office will be able to handle any questions, and we have our advisory commission and experts who have been working on this for the last year with us who will be able to work with them on any questions that come up. Contract negotiation period is not really a fixed period, but we think that the process that the State Procurement Office uses is one that's very collaborative. They take the proposal from the vendor and match it with our contract, put those two pieces together, send it back to the vendor. The vendor makes any comments on the contract as it stands at that point. All that information comes into one, and then we sit down together at a table and we negotiate anything that is out of play.
Okay, for the sake of those who are not really into what we're talking about, what role does the vendor play?
Senator Morissette, the vendor would be the contractor that would be providing the service of hosting the data and establishing a system that providers could log on to and identify their patients' information.
Okay. And the role of the vendor is extremely important because it has to be a high security. Were we talking about doing that in-house at one point, public health?
Senator Morissette, one of the first things that happened was we pulled together a steering committee that included members from all the different offices and departments that needed to work on this project. Our information security officer, Kyle Miller, identified risks involved with trying to host this and do this in-house and advised from the very beginning that we look to an outside vendor.
Dr. Bates, what's your understanding of that?
A couple questions, if I could.
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a request for proposal, not an awarding of a contract.
Correct.
So this is really a matter of asking for various vendors to look at this and make proposals back to you, correct?
Senator Bates, yes.
Okay, so this is pretty clear. And there will be some back and forth of the different vendors talking to them about what they can offer, what the security arrangements are, what the history of security is, all those kind of questions, correct?
Senator Morissette and Senator Bates, we've already done a good deal of market research where we asked all those questions in order to formulate the information that would go into a request for proposals. The proposers are actually providing us a proposal of exactly how they would be able to address each of the security requirements, each of the business requirements, each of the system requirements to the satisfaction of our team. And the analysis that's done after we go into test implementation would be an actual hands-on testing of the system to assure that it's being provided as advertised. In addition, the team will travel to at least one state where that vendor has implemented successfully to assure ourselves that that system in that state is working as we need it to.
There are 32 states?
Senator Morissette, 38.
38. Okay, what we're really talking about is electronic tracking of prescription drug sales, Schedule 2 through 5, what is it? And 4 through 4, okay. For the purpose of prevention of doctor shopping, and that you won't have multiple prescriptions written by different doctors for people who shouldn't be getting that drug, and which is a real problem. And Dr. Bates, who's one of the main movers of this idea and this bill, has personal experience of people coming to him, a lady from out of state who knows more about her, what was that, that she...
She had better record than her visit than I did.
Yeah. They're real pros.
And the other 75 doctors he visited in the previous 3 days.
And some of them...
By a corridor.
Yeah, some of the main proponents of this have been emergency room docs and so on. So this is something that we, it's taken a while to bring this together. And like all good things, you have to do it in bits and pieces. And we were able to get this far, and we hope to finish it off and get the vendor and get the program going. Through efforts of Dr. Bates, we have found the funding mechanism for it, which after the federal funds run out would be a very small fee on people who write prescriptions, very small, like $25 a year and so on. I mean, it's it works in other states. It has been successful. It has saved lives. And, you know, some of the stories that we've heard were from a mother whose son died from an overdose, and she found out too late that he's been getting these prescriptions and going to different doctors and so on. There are a lot of really sad tales. So this is a very important program that is going to come online soon.
May I ask a follow-up?
Absolutely.
All right. Mr. Bob Cummings in LFO, has he been looking at the RFP with you and vetting it with you?
Senator Morissette, Senator Bates, Bob gets what we call a dashboard once a week that's a report on the progress on every aspect of the program. He's also invited at any time to join us if any issues come up, and our ISO and our information security and our Office of Information Systems folks, technical folks, are in contact with him over the phone regularly.
Bob is the IT person we've hired in LFO to set up contracts and make sure these programs that most of us frankly don't understand, you know, are the contracts are written properly, and so we understand what's expected of the vendor, and the vendor understands what's expected of us. We've had issues with almost every single system we've ever bought, MMIS or any of them, and Bob has helped straighten some of those out and is now writing or vetting the contracts so that we don't get those problems again in the future. He's done a great job for us, and we appreciate his efforts the last year and a half. Glad to hear you're working with him. The only word of caution I give you to you is this is very sensitive information, as we all know. And the one thing we should do is if we need a little more time, get it just right, take the extra time. You know, we've waited 10 years for this. We can wait an extra 6 months or a year or 3 months, whatever it takes, to get a system that really works and protects people from break-ins, essentially, as we're talking about, people get information they shouldn't have. We have other systems already in place to do that. We've got one for HIV and some other ones that we track. That's why it's in public, in the public health department, because they have those programs there already. This would just be another one they'd have.
Right.
And done a great job of protecting those databases. They've never been breached. I'm not saying they couldn't be, but they've never been breached. So we hope this program will be set exactly the same way, with good firewalls and no problems. So I appreciate your efforts, and I appreciate allowing me to take part in your committee today. Thank you.
Okay. Anything else, Lisa?
Senator Morissette, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify. If anybody has questions at any time, feel free to call us, contact us. I did wanted to say for the record that the idea that emergency room doctors really want and need this system has come up with our advisory commission. We had emergency room doc testify for the advisory commission this last month, and he talked about programs within hospitals that give doctors bonuses for having high patient satisfaction. But when you turn people away and you don't give them the drugs that they want, they can't get high satisfaction scores. And so we're finding out additional ways in which we might be able to have an impact on the prescription drug program in the state. And some of it's through policy and procedures at institutions. So.
Well, and it's kind of interesting because I killed this bill in my committee originally when I first heard it. And ACLU, who's in the room, was involved at that time and still is involved, still opposed to it. When it first came to us, that was just before the Supreme Court was to hear the Death with Dignity bill, and I thought, no, this is not the time to start talking about this. And it took some time to bring me around to the fact that, yes, this is a real problem, and so there's another issue that has taken four sessions, and it'll go into the fifth session before it's done. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you, Dr.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, we are community-based care, client contact, transformation issues, John Mullen, Steve Gibson, Jim Carlson, Joe Green.
Green.
Okay. Whatever happened to the levels 14 through 17, John?
Mr. Chair.
Introduce yourself, please, and
Mr.
answer
Chair,
that question.
Members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. And would you repeat your question, Mr. Chair?
Well, we used to serve disability levels 1 through our up to level 17, and we eliminated the three levels, and those people, where are they now?
Mr. Chair, there was a study of the people that were actually on the program at the time and what happened to them. Mm-hmm. I'm not conversant with all of the details of it, but basically some people wound up in lesser levels of care. Some people were lost contact with, and some people are not living any longer.
Okay. It seems to me that you had a proposal that would have kind of expanded if they're somewhere in between, they would get care. Was that your proposal?
Mr. Chair, that wasn't my particular proposal. Okay. What I did during that era is advocated against the cuts and uh-huh. said that we would be suffering the consequences not only of the people that were cut off from services, but future people who had the same profile who wouldn't be served.
Now, Mary is taking notes, and when we come back in September, we'll deal with that.
Okay.
Okay. No, that is an issue that it's a cost shift, not a cost avoidance. Okay, go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Chair, again, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center, and I mention that again because our legal services network worked together on a number of issues. That includes Legal Aid Services of Oregon, Lane County Legal and Advocacy Center, Disability Rights Oregon, about issues that relate to contracting and transfer issues in community-based care. And just by way of a very quick background, community-based care, we've been down this road with a number of different issues and populations over the years. People with physical disabilities, seniors, people with developmental disabilities, people with mental health and addiction services, they're served by different systems in DHS, and going back to the DHR days, we're served in different ways. But basically, the point I wanted to make with all of that is a common goal really emerged with working with all of those populations, and that was that people, we wanted to make sure that people were living in the most independent setting, the least restrictive setting to meet their care needs. And while there have been a number of twists and turns to that over a period of time, we know what we've done in Oregon as far as seniors and people with physical disabilities, creating a model of helping to serve people in the community where we serve more people in the community community a higher percentage than any other state. We've since moved on with developmental disabilities, where we'll be serving all of the people that we serve in the system outside of institutions. And, of course, there's a lot of discussion and debate about what's to happen with the state hospital and community mental health. But basically, the common goal has been there throughout this whole discussion that we're all served well by people being able to work and live in the most unrestricted care setting that's possible for them. So we prioritized that as a state and as a legislature, but with all of the reorganizations and changes over a period of years, it's not surprising that we have a patchwork of statutes and rules. And this is one of the reasons why our legal services network got together, because we had concerns not only about the people who are being served within SPD, seniors and people with disabilities, but also in addictions and mental health. We did make some progress on a couple of issues, and Senator, you alluded to it earlier, Senate Bill 1061 in the 2008 session, which really dealt with the residential care assisted living facility issues and reimbursement rates. Basically, the issue being that we wanted to make sure that the Medicaid rates, as closely as possible, would track towards the private rate. Those commitments were important, and they were commitments not only in words, but also resources were allocated towards those. But we do believe that there's additional work that needs to be done on the consistency of the rules. In the core principles that are attached to my testimony, we've been meeting with SPD going back to 2007, working on these issues. And not only have we talked to SPD, we've also been talking to the industry, Oregon Healthcare Association, who you'll be hearing from later on, the Long-Term Care Ombudsman's Office, as well as hopefully the opportunity to work with addictions and mental health. So in the main, just wanted to say before turning it over to Steve Skipton for some additional information and details is that we're committed to working with all of the partners on this, and I think we've made a little bit of progress to date, but I also want to add a little bit of a sense of urgency that dates back to your previous discussion. Actually, as the committee unfolded today, you were talking about the division that's happening with DHS and Oregon Health Authority, creating two agencies. Addictions and mental health will go over to the Oregon Health Authority, while SPD will stay in DHS. So we have these long-term care facilities, these community-based facilities that have different rules when it comes to things like transfers and voluntary transfers and so forth. And Mr. Chair, you also talked about the situation with assisted living concepts over in Newport, which was one of the causes of our alarm to see people that we had hoped as a network, as a state of Oregon, from the legislation that was passed, that people by and large would be able to age in place and irrespective of their source of income that was supporting them in Medicaid. So these are some things that we would like to see changed in rule. And to get closer to what are the protections of nursing facility residents, have significant protections under state and federal rules. So with that, I would be happy to answer any questions, but Steve will give some additional practical examples of that.
Now, go back up just a bit to the division of powers here. Would you restate what you said?
Yes. The Department of Human Services, right now the Oregon Health Authority functions are in the Department of Human Services. They will become two separate agencies July 1st of next year. And the E-Board subcommittee this morning had quite a bit of a discussion about that, about a number of issues that have to be worked out about creating the governance structure for that, how shared services will work. But there are also a number of programmatic issues that have to be resolved. And this is one of them that we're hoping to get some consistency about transfer issues for all clients served by the current DHS.
Okay. So Senator Winders knows all about this, right?
Well, yeah, they're not really, but it does whenever you're splitting the agency out the way they are and putting all health functions into one division, you're bound to, because there's always overlap of programmatic when you get at the level of implementation. And so there was discussion this morning about shared service, which is like your IT service and some other services, and should that be shared. But in addition, is correct. There probably will be some programmatic as you look at how things are delivered in the community. And we are driving more and more to community service versus institutional service. So I think those discussions, and hopefully particularly addictions and mental health division, will be at your table.
Yes.
Because as we talk about those services, you can't separate them from the community activity as well, and that's where we're going. So I think there's still a lot of discussion, even though we're talking about implementing the health authority in July. There's still a lot of work yet to be done as you look at the various services that the state provides under DHS. We had the same problem when we took the youth authority out. I go back so many years now. We created the department with having all services that related to the human element, including employment division. We took them out at one time. We had the juvenile mental health at one. Mental health planning was in DHS before we started splitting. So we go through this. We have a big box, and then we decide that we don't like the big box because we're not talking to each other in the big box. And so then we say, well, okay, we need to now talk about putting generic-like services all together, which is what we're doing here with the health authority. However, there still is how do we do all the eligibility, because the customer really doesn't care about our boxes, and I think we forget about that. The customer wants to make sure that they can enter into our system, that they can get the services that they need. And so that's the discussion of making certain that they're lined up so when the customer comes in, whether particularly when we talk about the continuation of care issues, as we look at OPI, those issues, mental health and all those issues, we have to be able to talk about entry points that the customer still becomes the primary reason for our existence.
I agree.
Is that the conversation
yes.
that you're having?
Ms. Chair, Senator
Thank
Winters,
you.
If I might, I just think that that's a really important thing to underscore and particularly appreciate your interest in making sure that addictions and mental health is at the table. We had a conversation a week or so ago with James Taves, who's going to be talking to Richard Harris, to make sure that we all get all of the stakeholders together and try to do our best by those clients.
Okay. Thank you. And thank you, Senator.
Chairman Morissette and members of the committee, I'm Steve Skipton. I've worked for the last 25 years as a staff attorney at Lane County Legal Aid and Advocacy Center in Eugene. My clients are elders and younger people with disabilities. Most of them are on Medicaid. The rest of them soon will be after they finish spending their savings on their medical care. One of the focuses of my work is on long-term care issues. I want to first address access to community-based facilities for my clients. Probably 9 out of 10 of my clients over the years have wanted to get care in a community setting, for example, in assisted living. They feel they can maximize their independence and their dignity getting care in that kind of a setting. And we all know it's less costly to provide that care in that kind of a setting. I'm fond of referring to that as a win-win situation. It's good for the individual. It's good for the state budget. While my clients prefer community-based settings, it's not always true that the facilities prefer my clients. The facilities often prefer a private paying resident over a Medicaid resident for the simple fact that private rates are higher than Medicaid reimbursement rates. A lot of facilities, particularly assisted living, ask about an applicant's finances. They want to know if a person has enough money to pay privately for 6 or 12 or 18 months. If they can, they'll be admitted. If they can't, they may not be admitted. I have heard from numerous clients, families, caseworkers, that there exist waiting lists for Medicaid recipients, not necessarily for private pay, but for Medicaid. So access for low-income Oregonians to the facilities they would choose is limited, and it may be that a person who wants to get care in an assisted living facility and who should get care there can't because they won't be admitted. I think of that as a lose-lose situation. It's bad for the individual. It's bad for the state budget. We've already heard a reference to assisted living concepts. They're the bad actor And by no means do they represent the many good providers in this industry. But they have shown us what can happen when a decision is made to get out of the Medicaid business. They made that decision on a national level. We saw what happened here with Spencer House over on the coast. What assisted living concepts did was simply not renew their Medicaid contract. They let it expire. And when it wasn't renewed, they simply kicked out every Medicaid resident in the facility. Under the present cycle, the Medicaid contract is good for 2 years. Residents and families, I don't think, know this. They don't know that when they're admitted to an assisted living facility, that there's a contract that's running. It may have a year to run. It may have 2 years to run. But there's an axe out there that could fall when and if the facility decides to terminate its Medicaid contract. Worse, many of the residents are misled into thinking that their future is secure. They're promised that when they exhaust their savings, they can transition into Medicaid. That might be true the moment those promises are made, but we saw that a rogue provider, I'll call them, like Assisted Living Concepts, can make a decision at the national level which will renege on all these promises made to Oregonians here locally. The federal law that governs nursing facilities won't let happen what happened when Assisted Living Concepts decided they were going out of the Medicaid business and kicked out everybody from Spencer House. Under federal law, a nursing facility can withdraw prospectively, and I want to explain to you what I mean by that. Under federal law, a nursing facility can decide to terminate its participation in the Medicaid program, and as of that termination date, it need not accept anybody new as a resident who's on Medicaid. But it cannot evict the existing Medicaid residents that are there and the people that are about to spend down and transition into Medicaid who are there. What we want is to apply the nursing facility transfer rules that exist here in Oregon that follow the federal law and don't allow this kind of eviction. We want those principles to apply to all kinds of facilities, assisted living, adult foster, and nursing facilities. Mr. Mullen alluded to our core principles. Those are based on the nursing facility transfer rules. Those rules now, kind of oddly, I think, apply by statute to foster homes. They apply by law to nursing facilities. They used to apply by rule to residential care. Now they don't apply by rule to either residential care or assisted living. So when a facility, I want to explain to you also how a facility can terminate its Medicaid contract. It's very simple and it's legal. They just choose not to renew it. When that happens, it causes a real human tragedy. My clients tell me they're shocked, they're mad, but most of all, they're worried and they're scared about what's going to happen to them when they get the notice that they have to leave because Medicaid is ending, or they get a notice that says, like in the Eugene facility, we might go out of the Medicaid business a year from now. We're not sure. We'll tell you later. And they should be worried. There's a great deal of social science literature that points out that when older people and younger people with disabilities are forced to move, not surprisingly, their health suffers. Their mental conditions as well as their physical conditions get worse. Some even die. This concept is called transfer trauma. The nursing facility rules that we're hoping will apply to all kinds of facilities protect against this kind of trauma from occurring. Looking forward, we have suggested two proposals which we think might help our clients get in and stay in care facilities in the community. One, of course, is reimbursement. And I know that two work groups have been formed by seniors and people with disabilities to look at the present reimbursement structure, maybe change it, maybe increase it, but no changes have occurred since 2008. At the other end, we're proposing that Oregon, either by statute or by rule or maybe by contract, follow the federal law lead and not let a facility which terminates its Medicaid contract kick out all its Medicaid residents. we want that to be a true gradual withdrawal by attrition so that people there on the day that the Medicaid contract ends get to stay there until their care needs can't be met there anymore. In Washington State does this by contract. When a Medicaid contract comes up for renewal, Washington State asks the provider if they will promise that if they go off Medicaid at some point in the future, they'll continue to care for their existing residents. Most say yes, some say no. Or it could perhaps be done by agency rule here in Oregon. At any rate, we hope that it will be done. We don't want to see, again, a mass eviction of old and young people with disabilities simply because of their status on Medicaid. We hope that never happens again. Thank you.
Thank you very much, because that's really important to understand. And at one time, did we have that agreement with? I guess we had ORS. No, we had administrative rules that said this couldn't be done, but somehow they went away.
Chairman Morissette, I was looking at some notes. You asked earlier about 14 to 17, and I made some notes about the transfer rules that applied at that time.
Yeah.
And looking back at those notes, I found that at least in 2003, residential care had to abide by the same rules that applied to nursing facilities. That's no longer true. The residential care rules and the assisted living rules were combined, I don't know exactly when, but a couple of years ago. When that took place, the protection against the risk of eviction went away.
Interesting. Questions? Jim, you're up.
Can I ask you guys to get a little cozy there so we can sit at the table?
Sure. Okay, Jim Carlson is one of the stalwarts of the support group that has worked with DHS to provide a level of acceptable reimbursement to assisted living and residential care. And we've made some headway, I hope. We don't lose ground on that. So, Jim?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jim Carlson. I'm president of the Oregon Healthcare Association. We're a private, not-for-profit association that represents about 85% of the licensed nursing facility, assisted living, residential care facility providers in the state. First of all, I want to thank the committee for the time today, and I also want to thank the Oregon Law Center. We've had a number of meetings and discussions, including as recently as last week, and I think we intend to collaborate together because while we may not agree 100% on the best way to achieve the goal here, I think we're in full agreement on the goal, which is we want to make sure we've got as much Medicaid access for lower-income, older Oregonians and disabled Oregonians as we can achieve. I think you've got to look at some of this a little bit in the context of the history, and I think we've also got to realize when we talk about a quote-unquote forced eviction here, I've been doing this for 16 years now. It's happened one time. So let me repeat that. I've been doing this for 16 years now. It's happened one time. We had a rogue national company, national provider, who made a national decision that they're pulling out of the Medicaid program nationwide. Oregon, by and large, when somebody chooses to withdraw from the Medicaid program, providers choose to do what's called a gradual withdrawal. And what a gradual withdrawal means is that that provider will agree to care for all the Medicaid residents who they are currently serving for as long as those Medicaid residents remain with them, as well as any of the private residents who were admitted during the time period when they had a Medicaid contract who then subsequently spend down, and they will continue to care for them. And I think that's important to keep in perspective here that, like I said earlier, 16 years, one time. And so let's just keep that in mind. The history we had pre-2008 was that we had, due to a problem with Medicaid rates not having kept pace at all with the market, with increasing operational costs and regulatory compliance costs and everything else, we had a lot of providers entering into gradual withdrawal agreements. We started to see some Medicaid access issues start to develop throughout the state because, quite frankly, at the end of the day, those providers have cost shifting where they're making private pay residents pay higher rates to offset those Medicaid losses. And in some cases, a lot of those providers were no longer competitive in the private marketplace because their private rates were so high to offset their Medicaid that private facilities were charging lower rates than facilities with Medicaid contracts. And so that creates a situation where that organization is less competitive in their market. They're charging consumers, the majority of their consumers who are non-Medicaid clients were being charged more as a result. And we went in through a lot of good work, a lot of hard work on the part of yourself, Senator, and others, and we were able to, in the February 2008 session, pass Senate Bill 1061 and also legislation in House Bill 3626 that addressed some of these key issues and laid out some language of what we were going to do to try to provide better incentives to maintain access for Medicaid clients and to keep people in the system. And we were successful at that time, I think, in stopping the bleeding and stemming the tide of folks doing the gradual withdrawals from the program. But in terms of historic context, I think it's important to realize that what we did there with the resources that were greatly appreciated was in the second year of the biennium, in the 2007-09 biennium, we gave a COLA. Okay, so we did have a COLA and increased the rates. But taken in a six-year window of time, that is one COLA in 6 years. 2005-07, no Medicaid COLAs for assisted living residential care facility Medicaid providers. 2007-09, no first-year COLA, COLA second year. 2009-11, no COLA. Based on what we've heard rumored on the halls of the Capitol today, we may be facing a 9% allotment order on reducing existing rates by 9%. And you tell me what you think the prospects are for a COLA in 11-13. So put that in an 8-year context, and you'd be looking at one COLA and maybe one 9% cut on an allotment order over an 8-year period of time. And what you've got with these organizations is they've got payroll to meet. They've got health benefits for their employees. They've got a mortgage and debt service to meet on it. They've got utility bills. They've got a lot of real expenses, and it's just not as simple as saying we're going to make you contract to care for Medicaid providers no matter what we pay you. And I think from contract law standpoint, I don't think government should or can actually make you contract with them to provide services regardless what you're going to reimburse on the services. I think it's also important to realize that a number of the things that were directed in Senate Bill 1061 and in House Bill 3626 that have absolutely no fiscal impact whatsoever, but were things that were actually discussed and directed in terms of incentives and things to encourage more participation of providers in the system, nothing's happened on. We talked about Washington State was mentioned by Steve on what Washington does on the transfer rules. Well, what Washington does on their Medicaid contracts is they'll allow a provider to contract for X number of Medicaid slots. So if I'm a 60-unit assisted living facility in Washington, I can say I'll contract for 20 Medicaid residents, but I can't afford to allow my census to exceed, you know, one-third Medicaid because to be financially viable, I need to have two-thirds private. Washington permits that. We had a great work group, and we had a lot of discussion about that after Senate Bill 1061 passed and 3626 passed, but it's gone nowhere. There's been no discussion. That would cost zero in terms of general fund dollars or impact, and I believe would increase the number of providers who provide services to Medicaid clients, because we have a number of members who are 100% all private who don't have Medicaid contracts who would like to take a Medicaid contract because they would like to be able to accommodate residents who've been part of their community for many years when they do spend down and need Medicaid assistance. Essentially, since they don't have a Medicaid contract, those people have to move. If those folks were able to say, we would contract for 10 or 12 or however many Medicaid slots, they would be able to keep those folks and accommodate those folks in the same place. And that has absolutely zero fiscal impact.
Okay. I know we've discussed this, and I know Washington has a system where they get a bonus if they take so many, they get more money and so on, incentive. I guess I'm not up to speed in terms of why nothing has happened as a result of that, and I want to think ahead to the September meeting that we have, and Mary is taking notes, and to see if some of what you say, if there are no cost benefits that we can, you know, put into place, and I guess it could be done by rule or statute. Does Washington have statutory language that
it's done in a rule, I believe, in Washington, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
But you know, my point there is there are things that we can look at. There are things that can be done. We are very sensitive and aware of the resource situation the state is experiencing. But I think in terms of this is not as simple as saying, you know, make somebody do this or mandate that, because we have to be aware of what I'll call the law of unintended consequences, which is any provider can basically say at some point in time, you know what, I'm no longer going to do business with the state. The state's not a good business partner. But the other thing we're seeing, we talked about the rogue company assisted living concepts. What we're seeing they're doing in other states and what's being discussed by them is they're not only pulling out of Medicaid, they're actually de-licensing their facility. And they're no longer going to be a licensed care facility. In Oregon right now, the state, with one hand, is out aggressively talking to a lot of our members and providers and recruiting them to essentially be housing with services providers, to essentially contract with the state as part of the On the Move program and part of the Money Follows the Person program, and saying, you know what, we will pay you higher rates than we pay sometimes even in nursing facilities, and we can do physical plant improvements and do all kinds of wonderful things with all this money we've got and federal money and the like, and there's a huge emphasis on that. And a number of the providers they're talking to about this program and trying to say, will you come contract with us for these services, are currently operating licensed services where they're getting reimbursed lower amounts of money, and they're operating in a much more structured, much more regulatory environment. And I'll have to be honest with you, a number of our members have talked to us about, do we want to maintain even being a licensed facility as opposed to just moving strictly into the housing realm and becoming a housing with services provider where you don't have to deal with all the costs and the overhead and everything that's dictated through the, you know, the standards and the regulations that are in place. If you can get higher reimbursement here by contracting with the state than you can here. And so you get these perverse incentives out there, and we have to be very careful and take great care here that we don't try to just make a nursing facility-like regulatory model on these providers, because these facilities were never intended to be mini nursing facilities.
Okay. Now, there is a interesting situation, and Senator Telfer and I have a constituent. The woman lives in my district, but the facility is in her district, and it's run by her husband and her and both of them, and it's a four-bed place. It's and it's kind of interesting because there's a waiting list of people to get into it, and they take people out of the nursing homes who have 24/7 care, and it's a good move in terms of saving money.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, certainly in terms of if, and here's where we get into conflicting objectives and goals, okay? And here's where we have a real lack of clear policy direction and clarity that at least in the provider community right now is very confusing. Most of the providers want to contract with the state and provide the services the state is interested in contracting for. But there's a real lack of clear policy direction and understanding on the part of the providers right now. What services does the state want to purchase and in what settings? So if you want us to save money, we could do things, and we can do it in a lower cost structure over here on a pure housing with services model. We can deliver much lower cost services out here than in an assisted living or residential care facility environment. And right now, the state's actually offering higher reimbursement in that less regulated, less unlicensed setting. Okay, they will pay you more, okay, in that setting than they will over here for providing services in assisted living and residential care. Over here, it's kind of let's make a deal on negotiating rates. There's no published rate schedule or anything else, and you can actually get money to pay for all kinds of equipment and physical plant remodeling and all kinds of things that the resources just aren't over here for the Medicaid client here. So some Medicaid clients in some settings have access to a lot more resources and money than they do over in this setting.
Now that's on the move?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that would be correct in terms on how that program is being operated.
But that is a money follows the patient kind of.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there's federal grants that a number of states applied for and received, Oregon being one of them, where there's for a 12-month period for anyone relocated for a nursing facility, there's an enhanced federal match for 12 months. Okay, after that, it goes back, I believe, to a lower match rate. And so the state's able to do things with essentially a little bit more federal participation, and they're negotiating some, from a provider perspective, much more attractive packages in those settings. And so when Steve talks about things like transfer trauma and all these other things, these are very real issues, and great care has to be taken, when you're setting up service planning for people. And there's a lot more wraparound services, a lot more money and resources that's being invested for Medicaid clients who are eligible or picked for that program, as opposed to Medicaid clients who may be out in some of these other more traditional settings.
Okay. Now, I've heard a couple of things. One of them is that there are things that you think that the state could do that wouldn't cost the state anything, that would make the program more efficient, and for some reason that's not happening and so on. But I'm sure when I talk to the state, they'll probably say, well, yeah, that's true, but... Now, what I'm hoping we can do is by September, come together on some of these issues that need to be discussed. And statutory language is not always the best solution. In fact, it's better if it's a rule. Unfortunately, rules can be changed. Statutes can't. So sometimes you want to do a statute just to make sure it isn't changed. But rule is the way to go if we can. So that's something that I look forward to in September is...
Yeah. And Mr. Chair, just and members of the committee, we're very committed to keeping the goal in mind of trying to keep as much Medicaid access for all Oregonians as we can. And we actually do a pretty good job. About 77% of the assisted living facilities in the state currently have Medicaid contracts. 66% of the residential care facilities in the state currently have Medicaid contracts. We do not want to see a situation where we get a tiered system where wealthier Oregonians have a lot of options and choices that lower-income Oregonians do not have, and I think we share that commitment and that goal and objective, certainly with based on our conversations last week with the Law Center. But I think we have to take great care on how we approach these issues because providers have options beyond just dropping a Medicaid contract. Increasingly, it looks like their options just to no longer be a licensed facility and to go more into a housing with services arena where, there's a lot more flexibility and potentially a lot more resources.
Really? Housing with services? Just quickly just to say that we hope that this agenda item today has gotten some attention from the committee. Obviously it has, that there are some issues to be worked out. And I'm confident that if SPD and Addictions and Mental Health will get us together at the table, that we can work a number of these things out. As Mr. Carlson said, there are some differences in our approach about how to get there, but the idea about having Medicaid access for people and then being able to stay once they've had that access, I think is a goal that we have. The business about how we get there and how we would write the rules. So we would love it if you would have us come back in September and report on how well we're doing with that.
And we'll be in touch in the interim between now and September. Senator
Whitaker. Just a comment, because it's almost like sometimes I think I hear the same thing over and over again. And I believe it was 2001 when I chaired Human Services, mm-hmm. Ways and Means, that I dealt with the issue of rate. And at that time, I was very frustrated because the agency had gone out and encouraged the development of all the facilities and then did not want to pay in order to keep them afloat. And, you know, here part of this is also in a rate structure as well as access. And so at some point, I think we talk about what is our responsibility as a state in utilizing the service to the provider. It's not always that the provider is there saying, I have a service that I'm willing to provide for you, and what are you willing to pay for that service? Because I don't think any provider out there wants to kick out a patient.
Never.
It's never. And I think there has to be a meeting somewhere in between, because we're all talking the same thing. We all want access. We all want it to be in the community. And we revisit, seem like every few years, that we get so caught up in our rulemaking, and we don't go back and say, well, you know, this did work when we did it this time, and we did work when we did it that time, and maybe we shouldn't add on so much. One of my bills last session was to force us to try to go back every 6 or 10 years and look at what we're doing and see if what we said we were going to do is still working, instead of just, you know, we react to maybe one single incident. Our providers are getting terribly frustrated, and it's not just assisted living providers. And we can't exist as a state without the providers out there who are providing the service. And I think we ought to keep that in mind when we're talking about some of this. I'm sure that the three of you and the agency can sit down and come up with some way of working this out without constantly saying to our providers, you know what, hey, we're going to lay another one on you. And ultimately, what happens in the real world out there is that they're saying, you know, I've got the federal hoop, I've got the state hoop, I've got the county hoop, I've got all these hoops, and maybe I just don't want to provide this service anymore. So, I think there's time for a meeting of the minds of everybody that cares about what happens to seniors and people with disabilities. I know my good chair does. He's been working on it for years.
Well, and I appreciate your putting it in perspective, because you've worked on it longer than I have before I was here, and I really appreciate your presence in this. But what I'm hoping is, and we will be in touch during the interim to talk about these issues, and with the department, with Mary and James and so on, and see if we can't come back with some agreed-upon solutions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Appreciate that.
And give my regards to Tim Baxter. Okay. Update on healthcare worker influenza vaccine work group. All right. Katie King is afraid to come up. Is that it? Katie, would you please come up here and at least grace us with your presence, if nothing else? And there is a new book out that's over in the gift shop about capital crime. And there, you know, there's a really good story waiting to be written about murder on the mall.
Senator, maybe it's something we'll need to work on together.
Okay. Well, okay. Okay. Catherine?
Are we ready? All right. Chair Morissette and committee, for the record, my name is Catherine Bradley. I'm the administrator of the Office of Family Health, and I'm here this afternoon with Dr. Paul Cieslak, our immunization medical director, and Katie King from the Oregon Health Authority to give you an update on the healthcare worker flu vaccination activities. As you'll recall, during February legislative session, Senate Bill 1011 was introduced, mandating seasonal flu shots for healthcare workers with a process of declination. In the interim, the OHA has been working with other partners to look at whether we could pull together some recommendations to bring back to this committee in September. We did visit with governmental liaisons of five of the stakeholder associations during the last month and a half. On May 12th, we had a meeting with our work group, which included members from the Oregon Healthcare Association, the Oregon Medical Association, the Oregon Nurses Association, the Council of Local Health Officers, the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and the Office of Health Policy and Research, as well as our own Office of Public Health. In general, the participants agreed that vaccinating healthcare workers was a worthy goal in ensuring patient safety and staff health. We worked on some common definitions around healthcare facilities, healthcare workers, the declination concept, and on reporting. We also saw a copy of a draft annual reporting tool from our Office of Health Policy and Research, which looked like it would serve us very well as a performance metric, and also to provide information on recommendations for future interventions. At this time, the work group is interested in working towards some shared educational materials. We've got two more work group meetings this summer, and we'll be presenting some recommendations back to the work group in the fall.
Okay, and so your next group meeting is?
It's in my BlackBerry, Chair Morissette.
Oh, okay.
I believe, Chair Morissette and committee, we have a work group meeting in about mid-July and then about mid-August.
Okay. And you've had at least two so far?
Chair Morissette, we've had one meeting, the first meeting that you were able to join us on conference call. We had met previous to the meeting with all of the different
associations. Oh, that's right. Okay, you met with individual groups.
We did a round of meetings at that time.
Okay,
correct.
Okay, okay.
And then we had the larger, so we had an understanding of different perspectives and interests and concerns, and then that helped us in terms of bringing the work group together.
Okay. Okay, Dr. Cisak.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dr. Paul Cislak. I am medical director for the immunization program within the Oregon Health Authority and manager of the communicable disease program. I don't have too much to add to what Catherine Bradley just said about our progress toward vaccination of healthcare workers against influenza. I think there is agreement that that it's a patient safety issue, that it's an important thing to do. I didn't hear a lot of opposition to the notion that there could be a state mandate within at our first working group meeting. There was some concern about how much paperwork would be required, and I think we're still talking about that particular issue.
Okay. Katie, did you have anything?
Senator Morissette and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Katie King, and I'm the Government Relations Manager for the Public Health Division in the Oregon Health Authority. And one thing that I just wanted to add to Catherine's comments and Paul's is I felt like there was a real spirit of cooperation amongst the people that came together for the work group, and many of them are here now. And we're looking forward to working on this issue over the summer to try and figure out a couple of things, why healthcare workers have low vaccination rates, and what are some strategies that we can as a group come together and put forward to address those. So we are looking forward to reporting back to the committee in September with some recommendations.
What I would hope that you would bring back is a timeline, because we're not going to be able to accomplish everything, obviously, at once. And you know, there are some things that the limitations because of, well, the electronic transmission is not what it will be in a few years. There are just a lot of things that will happen to make it easier and easier to do this. And so I feel really, really good about this, and I don't think we needed a bill based on a couple of things. One is it's better to get the people who are impacted together and, you know, have them buy into the program, which is looks like that's happening. Secondly, you do have the authority, and I think that you have authority to do a lot of things if you choose to really put the screws down. You know, that's... But we don't want to go that route without the buy-in. And so I guess I would like to kind of see a timeline in terms of what people are, you know, willing to do right now, what they might be able to do if there's not a burden of reporting. That's a big issue, a burden. At what point would there not be a burden of reporting if certain things were true, if there was a software that you simply, you know, keep track and press a button, and that would be it. And so I think we're moving along, and I really appreciate the work that you've been doing. And hopefully when you come back, there will be a consensus of what we can do now and what we can do in the future. So.
Chair Morissette, please, committee, if I may, the Public Health Division really feels this is an extremely important objective of ours, and we have really appreciated the support that you have given to the importance of flu vaccination for healthcare workers. We also really did feel, as Katie mentioned, that there really was quite a bit of agreement. It was very impressive listening to the discussions around the table about just truly some of the outstanding work that is being done in our healthcare systems right now and the strong commitment in our healthcare and long-term care systems for not only protecting their residents or their patients, but also protecting the health of their healthcare workers. I think the question is whether we can bring enough consensus to understanding that we can really move this forward as sort of best practice examples across a healthcare system in general, or whether we need a little bit of a push from a state perspective with a mandate. That being said, I do think the reporting requirements, we have come much further along with identifying the form the Oregon Health Policy and Research Division is going to be asking for all hospitals to be reporting on, which will actually give us aggregated information on what this last season was like. And so I think also over the summer we're going to have more information on what the impact from this last season was with both H1N1 and regular flu, which will greatly inform our conversations.
Okay, and then the other thing that may be somewhat difficult is to identify who will be covered, because I know my experience being at the hospital with my wife, who was there a couple times, that there are transient people coming through who are workers. Some of them are interns. Some of them are there just for a short period of time and so on and so forth. They do have patient contact. Mm-hmm. What happens in the Peace Health cafeteria where you have a big mix of people? Well, obviously there are people who are not employees there, but I mean there's just a lot of things about, you know, an ambulance drivers and just the definition of a healthcare worker is something that I don't know that we've arrived at yet. So, Senator, did you have that?
I know we talked about just the two vaccines. Was any thought talked about pneumonia vaccine as well?
Chair Morissette, Senator Winters, we didn't really address the issue of pneumococcal vaccine. I think it's quite a bit different than influenza vaccine because it's not really a contagious disease. When you don't see pneumococcal disease coming in clusters and spreading through a population the way you see influenza.
Except that if you're older and infirmed and in the hospital or in the nursing home, you do.
When you see it in the nursing home, you tend not to see it traveling in clusters. It tends to be individual patients getting sick from bacteria that they tend to be harboring, for weeks or maybe even years in their nose and throat. It's sort of a different. It doesn't travel in epidemics in the same way that influenza does. So that if a healthcare worker has the pneumococcus, one wouldn't expect that it would then cause subsequent cases in the patient population.
Okay, we're looking forward. Not There will be a pandemic.
Yep.
There will be a tsunami hitting the Oregon coast. I mean, those are certainties. When they happen, we don't know. And suddenly the swine flu came along. If the swine flu had come along when I first introduced this bill, because I said when the next pandemic comes, well, there wasn't, the swine flu came after that. So something will happen. The world is getting smaller in terms of transportation. There are more and more pockets of poverty around the world that are spawning grounds for these, you know, Haiti, for instance, something could happen there and that would spread around the world very quickly. So we have to be ready. It's just a reality. So do it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much.
Spread the bug, is that what you said?
No.
Do it.
No, kill the bug, don't spread it. Okay. Thank you very much for being here, and we will adjourn and see you in September.